Today I'm going to introduce renormalization group and mainly focus on an intuitive understanding by introducing percolation theory and then also what we can do for the Ising model in one dimension. But before I get there, I wanted to address a question I got on Friday, which was about when mean field theory is valid. And if, you know, we have a low dimensional lattice, but if we have enough coordination numbers, say in 2D, would that be enough to make mean field theory valid? And I knew there were bounds related to dimensions, but I couldn't remember the exact relationship and way of showing it. So I wanted to put this up here. I'm not going to talk in detail about it, but this is a useful thing to have in your knowledge. And it's called the Ginzburg criterion. And it answers the question of when mean field theory is valid. And so the idea of when mean field theory is valid is you want to ask when fluctuations for a model, so let's say this delta magnetization squared, are much less than the average magnetization itself squared. And what you do is you are looking at them in the area of the correlation length. How far the correlation length spreads in each of the dimensions. And so this psi to the d is called the correlation volume. So you're looking at the fluctuations in this correlation volume and you're comparing it to the magnetization in this correlation volume. So you can write out the fluctuations then as this observable of the observable minus its average value squared. And then you know the magnetization is related to the sum of all your spin observables. And then when you write this out, and I haven't really talked about this, but there's another way to define the susceptibility in terms of these quantities. And basically, the susceptibility when you're at the critical point should grow as the volume because it should be divergent there. So we've talked about that, how it becomes infinite at the critical point. And so basically what happens is you have a sum over I and j here, and that came from the squared. But the susceptibility itself only requires a sum over one of the variables, I, and then you still have an extra sum over j. So this ends up being proportional to the susceptibility times one of these chi to the d, one of these correlation volumes. On the other hand, the magnetization itself, you know, when you're looking at that normalized magnetization average that ranges between minus one and one, that's just one of these, but then I have a sum squared. So I get the correlation volume squared, actually, on the magnetization side. So I get chi to the 2d. And so you end up with this condition when you're saying that the fluctuations of the magnetization must be much less than the average magnetization. You end up with this condition related to the susceptibility and the magnetization and the correlation length. And so then you can solve this for susceptibility and magnetization. And then we put in our definitions of the critical exponents because we know that susceptibility, magnetization, and correlation length are all related to particular critical exponents at the critical temperature T. So when you do that, you can solve and get that these things, this T to this power, has to be much greater than one. But remember, T is the reduced temperature. So what is T here? Is it going to be bigger than one or less than one when we're talking about close to criticality?
Small t is close to zero, right?
Yeah, it's very small. So basically the only way we can actually get this to be much bigger is it needs to blow up. So this sum of exponents needs to be negative here. Because if you have 1 over t, if you have 1 over a very small number, then you get something very big on this side. So what you end up with is that this sum of exponents must be less than 0 in order for mean field theory to be valid. And then you can solve for d, and you get this inequality of D is greater than these critical exponents. And so then you can put in our mean field theory expressions, and we actually get 4 for the Ising model. And this 4 is called the upper critical dimension. And so this is the dimension at which mean field theory becomes valid. And once we're at 4 or higher, we can trust those results. And that all comes from the fluctuations being insignificant enough compared to the average value. And so basically the upshot is the dimension of this will matter too, and that is related to this volume where you can have correlations in.
So any university class has their own upper critical dimension?
Exactly.
If you apply mean field theory?
Yes, and so they're not always 4. For example, the POTS model, which is another spin model, has an upper critical dimension of 6. And so this is just dependent on the model that you are looking at.
Mm-hmm. Are there systems that can somehow mimic being in higher dimensions so that mean field theory would be valid?
I see. So systems at low dimensions that mimic those at high dimensions. Yeah, I mean, I guess then they really aren't. Yeah, so you're saying you don't do a mean field theory approximation to solve this system, but you get the same answer as if you assumed mean field theory. Yeah, I mean, I guess in that case, they're just, the upper critical dimension is very low. I'm not. But maybe you're saying this system, it matches the mean field theory of another system. But if you use mean field theory with this system, you wouldn't get the mean field theory values of that other system. Maybe that's the point. Yeah, that seems like maybe something you wouldn't want to look for, because it's like sounds like it's much harder than to get the results for what. But I guess you're saying maybe. Yeah, I'm not. Okay, so you find some system, you don't know how to solve it exactly, but you have some other system that has a mean field theory that matches this one, so you can get that mean field theory of. Yeah, I don't know examples of that, but that might be difficult to prove too. But yeah, that could be something too. Any other questions on this? So for our first sort of look at renormalization group ideas, I'm going to start by talking about percolation theories. And these are basically a family of models I'm not actually giving a definition here, it's more of just why I'm thinking about them right now, that include a bond-based model that can be understood simply using RG. So how do they work? Well, first example I'll give you is actually a site-based model. So imagine we have a square lattice. I'm just going to put 16 points here. And then I'm going to say that each site has probability P of being marked. So for example, you know, you could think if P equals 0.5, you could just think of a bunch of coins and each one is flipped and it's either heads or tails. So as an example, I'm just going to mark some of these. And then I'm going to have open boundary conditions. So I'm not going to assume I can go around to the other side. This is just a system where this site is totally isolated from this site. And so then what I'm going to do is I'm going to identify clusters. So if we have nearest neighbors, basically I'm going to connect them to each other and form clusters. And then these are by themselves. So clusters are groups of contiguous nearest neighbor and so in this illustration I've selected each of these imagine with probability of P and then I've identified the clusters from this and so for my illustration I have four clusters, and they have sizes. Well, what are the sizes of these four clusters? I'm just asking you to count points. So if we look at them, we have two. They're just one. And then we have one that has a size 3 and one that has a size 4. So the next point I want to get at is that each system has a critical probability P equals PC. And so, you know, P is really our parameter for this system. If the probability is small, we won't have as many of these marked dots. If the probability is large, we'll have a whole bunch of them and we'll get larger clusters, presumably. And so the idea with the PC is that when P is less than this critical probability, we have isolated clusters. And by the way, PC is equal to, this is determined by numerics, 0.593 for the square lattice points. At P greater than PC, we have global connectivity. We're going to have one massive cluster that's going to include sites everywhere on the order of, you know, that's going to include, is going to be on the order of the volume of the entire system. And then we'll have, outside of that, we'll have small isolated clusters that are not part of the big cluster. But, you know, you can imagine as we increase P even higher, those will become part of the big cluster too. And then at P equals to PC, we have all cluster sizes represented. Plus a cluster that spans the whole system. And this is the incipient infinite cluster. Because of course, I'm showing this for finite lattices, but ultimately we would be scaling up and up. And so in the infinite system, this would be the first cluster to span the entire infinite system size. And so from this,
what is this probability again? So, like, with this probability, we connect the lattice points or something like that?
Yeah, so the important thing for this is we have all these sites, and these are all independent probabilities of each other. So we just go to each site, and, you know, we run our random generator, and if it's within that probability, you know, we will select that site. So if P is equal to 0.2, only one in five sites we will choose to mark. And then after that, we can identify what clusters appear. But these are totally independent of each other. So that's one key distinction from the Ising model, where you have the spins that are correlated, where the nearest neighbors have a favored lower energy if they're pointed the same direction. These sites don't care about each other. But the one knob we have is this probability P, and this is actually going to play the role of temperature in the percolation theories.
So we go at each site, we select or not select with given this probability, and like
yes.
Select some system, right, whichever is picked or not.
Yes.
And what and criticality corresponds to what?
Yeah. So if we do that, and then we identify the clusters at criticality, we will have find clusters of all possible sizes. And in fact, they'll follow a power law distribution, which we'll talk about the critical exponents in a moment. But there will be that first cluster that really extends across the entire system. So it's the first infinite cluster. And that will only grow after that. But that is the moment where the correlation goes to infinity, because this is going to be a second order phase transition or continuous phase transition as well with its critical exponents.
Mm-hmm. What is the P for which that is the critical probability? What is the initial probability of marking a site?
What is the initial probability? So I'm saying, are you asking about this PC that I mentioned for the square lattice? Yeah, so that's for exactly this example that I'm showing you. When P is equal to 0.593 approximately, that's the probability at which you have that first infinite cluster.
But is that independent of the probability of the site being marked?
Oh, I see. So no, it really is the probability of the site being marked. Yes. So So that's, like I'm saying, is kind of like our idea of temperature, but it's kind of reversed. If you have a low P, then that's sort of like a high temperature, because then you get these little bits of only a few clusters. And if you have a high P, you know, let's say even if we take it to one, right, then everything is going to be marked. It's like a totally ordered thing. And that's like a very low temperature system.
I would like to ask about the notion of an isolated cluster. Mm-hmm. Does this mean just we have, on average, multiple clusters in our lattice?
Yeah, I think isolated, I mean, in a way, they're all isolated. I'm not sure that that was the greatest description there. But, you know, these are just many small clusters. The whole thing, most of the sites aren't marked, and you might have one or two here and there. And then they will grow larger and larger as P gets close to PC. And then you get that first infinite cluster.
Yeah, I'm basically trying to understand the probabilistic nature of it, because maybe naively I would assume that there is a chance that we will have a single cluster for P less than PC. I mean, it's randomness.
There is a sense that we have a single cluster. I mean, you're saying if you flip them in a way, then you're thinking about the 1 minus P probability. Is that what you're saying if you're thinking about the unmarked sites? I mean, then that's just the total reverse of this.
Not necessarily. Maybe, but not necessarily. I just meant that, you know, that there is some probability that we will, that the points will be marked in such a way that there could be just one cluster. But I assume we're talking about...
Oh, I see. There would be some tiny probability that everything was selected. I see what you're saying.
Mean values, right?
Yes, this has to be about mean values, ultimately. Yes, that's right.
Is there a way to think of percolation theory in terms of like physical degrees of freedom, like, I don't know, paramagnets on a lattice?
Yeah, I'm not as familiar with the applications of percolation theory myself. There is a lot. People who do work in this area, but I'm not so
familiar. So for now, it's just more mathematical.
Yes, for now, it's just going to be an illustration of a simple way, because we still have a continuous phase transition to understand this and understand the general features of renormalization group. Yeah, go ahead.
It's a naive question, but what is the notion of time in this? It has the probability of, you start from a just unmarked lattice. Mm-hmm. Is it at each time it has the probability?
Like, I see. So what is the notion? There's not really a notion of time here. So the point is, you could create a configuration. And you know, you as a person doing it, or as a computer, they would select a probability for each one. But then you would take that as one configuration. And then you could create many other configurations doing the same rule. This goes back to this idea of an ensemble and average it, you know.
But, so you're not waiting for it.
Yes, yeah, you're not waiting for it.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about this incipient infinity cluster in the probability, is this already a global connectivity?
This is the first example of a global connectivity, but it's generally very long and stringy, and it takes up zero of the volume of the system when it first appears. And then, you know, then of course, as you increase P even more, it will extend to take up a finite part of the volume and then the full part. So as I mentioned, this will have a continuous phase transition, and there is a concept of a correlation length here. And like I said, the P probability is playing the role of temperature in this system. And so this correlation length actually will give us the size of finite clusters. So basically, when P is less than PC, it will give us, where we have the many small clusters, psi will be some finite number here that will be growing larger as p approaches pc. Then it will blow up at pc, because that's when we get that infinite cluster. Then p greater than pc, we're going to have that infinite cluster, and it will just grow in size. And so then finite clusters are fewer and fewer, and so then this correlation length, though, is measuring the size of the finite clusters, again, that are not part of that global cluster. And so I'll just say smaller. As p gets larger. So this quantity is going to be small, you know, when p is small. And then it will go up to infinity when p is equal to pc, and then it will get small again as p gets greater than pc, and it gets larger and larger. And then one more note before I show some slides. To get another idea, I already analogized the p probability to temperature. There is an analogy to the magnetization as well. And this is this big, you know, big script p. Unfortunately, it's another p. This is the probability of being in the infinite cluster. So if you have a dot, you ask, does this point belong to the infinite cluster? And this goes as p minus pc to the beta, because this is our magnetization order parameter, basically, for this system. And this only has a value when p is greater than or equal to pc. You know, just going along with the analogy for the physical models we've looked at, where this beta exponent for finite temperature phase transitions is defined for when the temperature is below pc, sorry, below tc. This one is for when the probability is above PC, because they're kind of flipped. And so I'll just draw it up here so that hopefully everyone can see it. If we were plotting P versus this magnetization, then the maximum value we could get is 1, because 1 is the, you know, 100% probability that your point belongs to the infinite cluster. And so at p equals 0, and all the way up until we get to pc, we have 0 probability because there is no infinite cluster. And then at this point, we have our critical point, and then we will move up to probability of 1. And so this is really very similar to the magnetization in terms of temperature plot that you would see. Any questions about this?
Mm-hmm. I think I may have misunderstood what you mean by a cluster that spans the whole system. Do you mean that there would be a cluster that goes, let's say, from the leftmost point to the rightmost point?
Yes, that's what I mean. Okay. So you can connect all these dots into a cluster, and it extends all the way from the left side to the right side.
Then you have to also connect from bottom to top, or just left to right is fine?
Yeah, just left to right is fine. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and show a couple of slides here. Let me see. So I'll plug this in. Put this here. Let's see if it works. Okay. So now we're going to start thinking about what renormalization group would involve for this system. So again, this is just an example of the types of configurations one could form for the square lattice. So on the left-hand side, you have p equals 0.2, and you've selected various of these dots. And you have clusters, but there are many different clusters with relatively small sizes for each one of them. And remember, for the square lattice, I have this p close to 0.593. And so this probability is very close to criticality. It's just under criticality. But I think the idea is you have one large cluster that is going to be, would be close to being the incipient infinite cluster with many other clusters around it. And then here's an example on the other side of things when we have a really high probability and there's basically only one cluster you can really even identify with everything connected. And so I just want to give you an idea of when p is greater than pc. So this is an example configuration for that, and you can see all this connectivity. The idea of renormalization group is to say, well, what if we had this system, and we just, this is an example of sort of tiling it. And what if we were to replace this block with a single point that represented it? And for this, I just want to give you an idea of zooming out, where you're changing the scale. Because the point is at criticality, we have something called scale invariance. But then when we're not at criticality, we don't have that. And so if we were to take this and just tile it more and more and more, you see we have these bluish-purple dots. And the screen just looks more and more bluish-purple. And so the point is, if we do something called a renormalization group transformation and p is greater than pc, that's what's going to happen. As we zoom out again and again and again, our system is going to look more and more and more like just the solid purple-blue color. So we are going to flow, we call it flowing, to a point, the point where p is equal to 1, and everything is just the probability 1. On the other hand, if we're below pc, we will flow to something where everything is just white, So we're going to flow to a point with a probability 0. And PC is going to be in the center. And the interesting thing about PC is if you were to tile this and again and again and again, it would just look the same as what you had before. So PC is the fixed point with scale invariance. In this case, it's unstable because if you go just a little bit higher or lower, you're going to flow to the other points. But if you are right at PC, no matter how much you do the renormalization group transformation, you just end up with the same system that you had before. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and get rid of this slide. And Craig or whoever's there, you can feel free to lift the screen now. Okay, so I'm going to speak qualitatively for a moment longer, and then we'll get quantitative with the percolation group and see what this is. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm kind of confused how at a particular probability we get a single cluster, you know, like a, that's connected throughout. I mean, what I would imagine is if I increase my p, greater than bc, there should be more probability of me getting a bigger cluster, a single cluster, which is big in size.
Yeah, that sounds right. So wait, what did you take issue with?
But when we saw the first slide, I think in at BC, I saw like a big cluster which was connected.
Mm-hmm.
And when P was greater than BC,
yes,
you can see that they're separated. You know, we could not see a big cluster. But like,
oh, but those were all connected. So there were holes in it, and those were points that were not marked. But everything else was connected at that high value of P.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, I'll put these slides up so you can look at them. So yeah, I'll go ahead and put those up on the portal if you want to check it again. So basically, at P greater than PC, if we do this thing called, you know, RGT, we are going to be driven to P equals 1. At P less than PC, we'll be driven to P equals 0. And then at P equals PC, it's similar at all scales. Or a fixed point. And so for an example, we're going to do another percolation theory that's very similar to the one I just showed you on the square lattice, but I'm picking this one because it's even a little bit simpler to look at, and we can get the exact value and see the fixed point easily. So this is going to be real space renormalization group. For bond percolation. And the idea is similar to what we have before. We are still going to have a square lattice. But here, instead of talking about marking sites, we're going to mark bonds instead. So we will be placing bonds with probability P. And so we have something like this. I'm just going to place some bonds here. And so each one of these, you know, nearest neighbor bonds could be either left blank, or we could place a bond there with probability of P. And so again, I'm illustrating four clusters. With sizes 1, 1, 2, and 3 for this example. And so for real space, 4 clusters, okay. for real space renormalization. We're going to use a procedure called decimation that we'll talk about with the Ising model as well. And basically the idea is if we take sort of a 2x2 grouping of bonds with some probability P, we want to just turn that into a simpler block with just two bonds that has a probability P prime related to it. So, you know, we're going to go from 2^8 configurations, because there are 2^8 possibilities we could get here for our 8 bonds that could each have 2 things. And we're going to go to 2^2 only. And so then the question is how in this case? And then if I basically want to keep the essential information about the system somehow when going from P to P prime. So what is P prime in terms of P? Okay, and so the criterion, which you may discuss some in a future tutorial, because it's a very simple idea, but you know there are a lot of subtleties to it and questions that could arise. And basically my criterion, because ultimately I'm interested in the question of when we get these infinite clusters. So what I'm going to say is if there is a horizontal path across the cell. So that's this 4x4 thing. Then I'm going to say it contributes to P prime. So I'm looking at one way that I could create, you know, this infinite cluster as I'm tiling things across. So I'm replacing, let's say this is already 4x4, some piece of a huge thing. I'm replacing it with a simpler thing that just has some P prime associated with it. And so what it comes down to is how can we do that with these bonds? And you'll notice, well, you know there are other vertical bonds here too that I could play with, but, and this is something that you can think through yourself, I don't actually have to include the other vertical bonds in order, it doesn't change the math of what I'm going to do when I write P prime in terms of P. Because what I'm asking about is clusters that extend across just this cell. And so this bond is going to be important because it affects whether, say, this bond is connected to that bond when I'm asking out connected clusters that reach across. But these bonds actually have no bearing on whether these horizontal bonds are connected to each other within this cell. Okay, well, the first way we could do that is just suppose we selected all of these bonds. That version of the cell certainly extends across the cluster, and this has a probability of P^5 because, you know, I've for each one of these, I need to select it with probability of p. So that's p to the 5. Another type of configuration that would contribute is this one. I mean, we actually have kind of two clusters extending across. And this one would have a probability of p to the 4 because we selected these four. And then we did not select this one. So we have 1 minus p there. Then we can do something like this. And they're actually kind of, well, how many ways can you make a shape sort of like this where I've left out one of these horizontal bonds? Because I'm really just trying to count sort of different categories of these. So you know, all the horizontal bonds are present except for this one. So how many things like that could you make, you know, thinking about rotating it in different directions and whatnot? Oh, you have a?
Four.
Is that what you said? Yeah. Because there you could miss this bond, or you could leave this bond missing, or this bond missing, or this bond missing. So we have four. And then we have still selected four bonds with probability of p, and then we didn't select this one, so that's a 1 minus p. We get something like this, too. How many of things like this were we, like, are missing two of the horizontal bonds?
Two.
Yeah, two, exactly. Could go this way or this way. So we have two. And then we have p to the 3 times 1 minus p squared. And then we have something like this. How many of these do we have? And I mean, really, it comes down to counting. Somebody else counting it differently could have put these and these in the same category, right? Because it's just two horizontal bonds missing. But since I already said, OK, these are like two missing on the same line, these are two missing on opposite lines. So then you can pick either one of those. So we have 2p cubed times 1 minus p quantity squared. And then we have this kind of thing, because after all, we still have one that extends across. So even though this one doesn't extend across, that's fine. I'm still going to count it. So, and then this is empty. There are four ways that it could be empty. So I have 4 times p cubed times 1 minus p squared. And then finally, the most minimal thing that still counts for us is just two lines here, and it could be up or down. So we have 2p squared, and then there were three things that were not selected, 1 minus p cubed. And what we're going to say is that this is going to be equal to our new p prime. So if we had some huge lattice and we did this decimation where we turned these groups of 4 by 4 into groups of 2 by 2, we would have a new problem with a new probability that we would call p prime. And that would be the system after the renormalization group transformation. So p prime is just equal to 1 RGT of p, where RGT is precisely this polynomial that I've given you. So then you could have the question of, when is p, because it is true, it'll turn out that there is some p value where if you do this RGT, you get the same p back. And this is the idea of a fixed point. And that is, and I'm just going to tell you, because you can imagine doing this. You say, okay, P is equal to this polynomial, and you have this fifth degree equation. It turns out there's a stupidly simple answer for the bond thing, and that's just P equal to exactly 1/2. So you can, and so you can easily do this yourself, look at 1/2 to the fifth. You know, in this case, P and 1 minus P are the same. So actually, you get a bunch of P's to the fifths and then some number, and then you can solve it, and you get P times something, and you get 1/2. But in this bond case, it's quite nice. And so that is actually tells us then that PC equals 0.5. And then we can have something called a flow diagram. Where we have P equals 0 here. We have P equals 0.5 here. And we have P equals 1 here. And what we would find is that when P is greater than 0.5, if we put things into this polynomial, we'll get a bigger number. And in fact, you can see this if we plot, let's plot P prime versus P. What we're going to find if P equals to 0.5 here is that it's something like this, where it's exactly equal to 0.5, and then it goes to 1. So when P is less than 0.5, you get something that's smaller than 0.5 here. When P is greater than 0.5, you get something larger than 0.5 here. So, you know, it's just going to be a cycle that keeps reinforcing itself. If P is greater than 0.5, we do an RGT, we get something bigger. Now we have something that's still bigger, and then we get something even bigger, and even bigger, and even bigger, and so on. So what we find is that if we're on this side, the RGT in the flow, if we keep doing things, we'll push it over to P equals 1. And then if we're on this side, it will bring us down to 0. And so this is an unstable fixed point. NP. And that's the main idea of what I wanted to talk about with percolation theory. I'm going to move to the Ising model from here and then show some analogies between the two after. But let's go ahead, let's see what time it is. Yeah, I'll take some questions and we'll take a 5-minute break after that.
Mm-hmm. So after we do the transform, so how does the new building block look? I'm a bit confused, so.
Yeah, so the new building block, you know, imagine this was infinite, you know, and we replaced the 4x4 by the 2x2. So we'd have something that was still infinite, right, if it really were infinite. And then, but now we have a new probability P prime. So now we could place all the bonds there and say, what is the system we have? Well, it's going to be this, it's going to be at basically a higher, if we started at a P greater than 0.5 and we did one of these, this would flow us to a system that had even a higher value than 0.5. If we did it again, we'd go even higher. So this decimation procedure flow that puts us along this renormalization group flow line. And that comes from this polynomial, because this polynomial, if we're at P, yeah, this is a plot of it. If we're at P greater than 0.5, it will take us to some number that is also greater than 0.5, and it will just continue to grow to 1. Or if we're at less than 0.5, it'll take us down to 0.
But sort of the building block on the lattice, how does it look like? Is it like this or like that?
Oh, okay. So you would have a new lattice, and then you could imagine the types of clusters that would form from the P prime on that new lattice. And eventually you'd end up with some new lattice with a P prime equals one. And so then everything would just be a bond in that lattice. If that's if you were started at a point where you were greater than P. If you're starting from a point when you're less than P, you continue to do this RGT until you end up with a lattice that has no bonds on it at all. Wait, in a moment. Because if you think about this theory, it really is just defined by a lattice and a probability, right? That is what the theory is. Because the probability from there then tells you what types of bonds and what types of structures you would get on the lattice. So each RGT gives you a new lattice and a new P. Okay, go ahead.
When you defined a P prime, why did we stop at the two on the same side, not two bar?
Oh, right. So if we had a bar here and a bar there, but they weren't connected to each other, then that would not be a cluster that spanned this cell. So the question is about building clusters that span this cell.
Okay. P0 and P equals 1, are they called stable fixed points, or are they just stable?
Yeah, these would, yeah, in terms of this P variable, yeah, they would be stable. Yeah, this one's kind of funny in that there's nothing that makes sense on this side of it, right? Because that'd be a probability greater than 1, or a negative probability on this side, but yeah. There's yes.
Think about this, so you're trying to like replace this block with this one. I think about it maybe like putting a point in the center of all of those blocks and seeing if they're connected, and if they are, then I just, is that what this is? So,
yeah, in a way. You could.
Too much. Okay, I see. Yeah.
What's the physical? So, Emily, so this whole procedure of like, what do you call it? Like
decimation, yes.
So, for example, the example you drew, just an explicit example,
mm-hmm.
if I decimated that, I would just get an empty lattice.
Oh, yeah. So I was only illustrating with these cells places where bonds could be put. Maybe that's what's confusing some people. So I was just saying, hey, this is a 4x4, or it's really 2 bond by 2 bond cell. And I want to replace it with just a 1x1.
Oh, yeah, but I'm saying like the example to the left of that.
Oh, this one.
Like the explicit one where you drew out the bonds.
Oh, yeah.
If I decimated that.
Then, yeah, I mean, if you said that like this thing was a cell, then that would be.
Awesome. Okay. Just like condensing every 2x2 block.
Yes.
Yes. In terms of energy scales and normalization. So, is the sense that is that sense in this case here the fact that we are sort of ignoring diagrams and configurations which have, let's say, corrections? I mean, I'm trying to think of it in these terms. Like, what would be we are renormalizing in this case.
What are we renormalizing?
Yeah.
Oh, you're thinking in terms of diagrams. is what you're saying.
Not necessarily, but usually, usually the normalization group connected to a normalization.
It is connected to it, and I think that that will become clearer as we move on in this course. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So is this criterion we choose just like an RG scheme or something like that?
Yeah, that's a decimation scheme. I would say this criterion we chose.
We get it. Why don't we consider ones like this? Two lines.
Emily, mm-hmm. Why don't we consider ones where you start top left, go down, and then go to across?
Stop. Right. So the point is, if we start from the top left, you would be able to go across whether you included that bond or did not include that bond. And so what you'll get is you would get some piece times a p plus some other piece times a 1 minus p, and that just adds up to 1. So that's kind of the subtlety of this. I made things as, you know, simple to write as possible, but, you know,
yeah,
it's
okay,
simple.
That's perfect, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's come back to our friend, the Ising model in 1D. As you know from your tutorial, you could actually solve that one exactly for 1D in a fairly straightforward way. In this case, we are going to solve it again, but solve it with RG. Okay, so the energy expression in terms of, remember, this is a spin configuration. Is the model we know with the nearest neighbors. And again, we're going to do a type of decimation here. And so if I think about the 1D lattice, what I'm going to be doing is examining it in terms of pairs. And rewriting it in terms of a new lattice, where each point in the new lattice is formed from a pair of the previous one. And for the 1D case, there's a nice way to do that, starting with the partition function. So we're going to sum over sigma 1, sigma 2, up to sigma n of e to the beta j, sum over sigma i plus 1. So this is something simple we can do in 1D, and we don't have to worry about factors of half or anything like that, because if you just take I and then I plus 1, that links one site with its neighbor to the right, the next site with its neighbor to the right, the next site with its neighbor to the right, and so on. So we are counting all the bonds in this way. Yeah, and right now I'm just going to think in terms of beta and j, not with the h. And so I can actually write this, and I think you saw this in tutorial, as a trace, well, it will end up being a trace, because you know that this thing has to equal some number. So some V matrix that can be sigma 1, sigma 2, V sigma 2, sigma 3, up to V sigma n, sigma 1. Move these a bit higher. And this, by the way, is just trace of this V matrix to the N, but it doesn't really make sense until I tell you what the V matrix is. So V is equal to V plus plus, V plus minus, V minus plus, V minus minus, and these entries are all e to the beta j, e to the minus beta j, e to the minus beta j, e to the beta j. Because the idea is, you know what you have, you could write as, since you have a summation up here, you could write this as a bunch of products of numbers, of e to the plus beta j or e to the minus beta j, depending on whether these nearest neighbor pairs are aligned or not. And we're going to sum over all possible combinations of whether they are aligned or not. And so the another way you can write it is just, if they're both up, you know you better get e to the beta j. If they're both down, you should get e to the beta j as well. But if they're down up or up down, you have the minuses. So this is just a way of then putting in every possible combination of e to the plus beta j and e to the minus beta j for all of the nearest neighbor pairs in the lattice. And since you're summing over sigma 1 at the beginning and summing over sigma 1 at the end, and then you have these repeated indices, sigma 2, sigma 2, sigma 3, sigma 3, you could also simply write it as this matrix to the nth power and then taking the trace over it, because the trace comes from the diagonal at the end after you've multiplied everything. Does that make sense?
Why are you considering h equals 0 in the partition?
Because I'm just looking at the Ising model when the field is equal to 0. It's a little simpler to write this way. We might return to it. I can't remember if I put it with h not equal to 0. So, because we can keep h equals 0 and still look at the critical point, you know. In fact, if we had a constant h not equal to 0, I mentioned that you actually don't cross through the critical point if you keep h constant and finite. Mm-hmm. OK. So now we can sum over half the spins, because this will really get to our idea of wanting to write a new partition function in terms of the decimated spins. Let's just take every other spin and go ahead and sum over it so that we can't see it in our partition function form. So z, we can also say, you know, I have v sigma 1, sigma 2, v sigma 2, sigma 3. Let's just sum over the sigma 2s. Then they'll disappear. And, well, what is v times v? We could just say that's v squared, right? So all I'm doing, I'm not changing anything at all right now. I'm just changing the presentation of it so that it maybe can give us an idea of how we can actually do this decimation. So sigma 1, sigma 3, up to sigma n minus 1. So I'm going to keep a sum in terms of these odd spins. And then I'm going to write v squared sigma 1, sigma 3, v squared, sigma 3, sigma 5, up to v squared, sigma n minus 1, sigma 1, bringing myself back there. And so this is really exactly the same as this. I just decided to rewrite it so that I would only have to think about the variables of the odd numbers. And now I'm going to go ahead and rewrite these in terms of S1, S2, up to S of n minus 2, because I'm going to think about, I'm not going to change the math yet for this. Let me move this a little higher so you can still see it. But I'm going to say, let's think about it in terms of these new spins for a decimated lattice, whatever that's going to be. Okay, and so the goal is to really make this partition function look again like what we began with. Because we had a bunch of things that were a product of v's. Now we have a bunch of v squareds. I want to write these as basically a bunch of v primes that have a new transfer matrix that resembles the transfer matrix I had before. So one note, since beta j always appears as a product, I'm going to set, I'm going to write things in terms of a variable k equals beta j, just so I have fewer things, and this is really going to be the parameter that I'm asking about when I'm looking at this problem, and whether I'm moving towards or away from a fixed point, and that sort of thing. So, as a note, we are trying to match v, which was equal to e to the k, e to the minus k, e to the minus k, and e to the k. Well, I can write out what v squared is, and v squared is equal to, if I take this column and this row and multiply it by this column, I should get e to the 2k plus e to the minus 2k, and I will get the same thing in the other diagonal piece. And now if I take this row times this column, I actually get e to the k times e to the minus k, and then I get e to the minus k times e to the k. So I get two ones. So I'm just going to get twos on the off diagonal part. So I can write that as, let's go ahead and put a 2 out front, because what is this thing equal to? Which mathematical function can we write this as?
Cosh,
exactly. And it's actually going to be 2 cosh, because there should be a 1/2 there, but there isn't. So I'm going to put a 2 there. So we get cosh of 2k, cosh of 2k, and then, whoops, then we should just have 1 and 1. Which you can do a few kind of annoying sets of massaging of this, because remember, we want it to ultimately look something like this. So you can ultimately write it as 2 times cosh of 2k to the 1/2 in the front, and then this matrix as e to the 1/2 log of cosh of 2k, e to the minus 1/2 of log of cosh of 2k, e to the minus 1/2 log of cosh 2k, and then e to the plus again, 1/2 log of cosh 2k. And you can see where this is coming from. If you have 1/2 times log, you could also write this as cosh 2k to the 1/2, and then you have e to the ln. So you have cosh to the 1/2, but then you have another cosh to the 1/2 out front. So that will just give you this term that you want. And then this would end up being 1 over the square root of cosh 2k. And so then you have the square root of cosh 2k. And so those will cancel. And so the point is, this is exactly the form that we want. And now we can say, you know, that this piece right here, this is going to be our k prime for the decimated lattice. And then I'm going to call this piece A. And then this piece is really going to be my V prime. And this is really what is special about the Ising model in 1D. You normally can't do this so that you're able to really write the partition function exactly as a partition function of a decimated lattice, as we're going to do, where there are no approximations or no adjustments made. But this is what you can do for the Ising model in 1D. So to really reiterate what we have, if we take our initial partition function, which we wrote in terms of n particles, and k, which as a reminder is just beta times j, what we've seen from here is that we can exactly write this as a summation from S1 to S2 up to Sn by 2, V squared S1, S2, V squared S2, S3, up to v squared s n over 2 s1. And then this, though, can be written just in terms of, instead of v squareds, let's use v primes for each of these, where I define v prime in this way, and then I'm going to have a, and then there are n over 2 of these, so this is a to the n over 2. And notice there's no dependence on the s's for this a, so I can just put it in the front. And so this is really a, which we could say has a k prime dependence, because these are our k primes in here. This is the k prime there. Well, we can write this in terms of k prime. I didn't do that, but we can. And you, I think you have it in your notes. A to the k prime to the n over 2. And then this is just the trace of v prime to the n over 2. And it really looks very much like the trace of v to the n. Now we have the trace of v prime to the n over 2. So what I would say is that zn of k is equal to a of k prime to the n over 2 times a new partition function, but it's still z. It's the identical function as before, but instead of we modify the argument slightly, whereas instead of n particles, we write it for n over 2 particles instead, and instead of k, we put k prime in here. Okay, so this is the idea of how the decimation works. Now let's ask ourselves, we were able to look at this p in terms of a p prime. Now we have our k, which I, like I said, is related to the temperature. We should be able to relate our k to our k prime and figure out where the fixed points are in the Ising model case, just as we found where the fixed points were here. So where are the fixed points? And by now we do know the answer we should get. We're not going to assume it, but we know it. What happens with the Ising model in 1D? Where do you get long range order?
Zero.
Yeah, the answer is going to end up being TC or T equals zero, which corresponds to beta equals infinity. Okay, and so the Ising model in 1D is, quote, easy in a way because we can use this real space renormalization to get the exact answer, and it works nicely, but it still takes quite a few nice little mathematical insights. And so that's what I'm doing here. So remember, here we talked about P prime in terms of P. We are interested in K prime in terms of K, but for reasons you'll see in a moment, it's easier to think about the hyperbolic tangent of these K primes and Ks. They allow us to write things in a more straightforward way. So you can do some math here. Let's go ahead and put in what K prime is equal to. And then you can figure out what the tanh is of these things. Remember, you're going to do e to the plus minus e to the minus divided by e to the plus plus e to the minus of this stuff. And basically, you'll get that this can be written as cosh of 2k minus 1 divided by cosh of 2k plus 1. And then you can write this actually as e to the k minus e to the minus k over e to the k plus e to the minus k quantity squared, which is nicely for us just the tanh of the original k squared. And so you can see this, right? If you take e to the k times e to the k, that's e to the 2k. This one times itself is e to the minus 2k, so there's your cosh piece. And then you're going to have the cross terms, which will contribute to the 1 here. And it's 1 minus the other, so you'll get the minus 1 there. And so the point is, if you let x be equal to tanh of k, you get a very nice x of the decimated system is simply equal to x of the original system squared. And so this is the piece that we can build off of. And actually, when we're thinking about this x, we see that it's far simpler than relating p and p prime. So x prime is equal to x squared. So another way to think about it is this RGT of x is equal to x squared. So then, what are the fixed points? How do we find those for this? Because basically, we want to be able to keep doing this RGT and get the exact same thing. So to find fixed points, you just need to solve the equation of when does x equal x squared. Because then if we do the RGT of x, we just get itself again. We do an RGT of x, and we get itself again, and so on. So what are the solutions for this?
Zero.
Yeah. Because you can think 0 is going to be equal to the RGT of 0. It's going to be equal to RGT of RGT of 0, and so on. So you can do the decimation procedure again and again and again, and we will still have what we began with. So we can make an RG flow diagram. Where, first of all, if we're thinking in terms of x, we have x equals 0, and we have x equals 1. And then we can think about, okay, what happens if x is less than 1 and we square it? What happens to squaring a number less than 1?
Mm-hmm. It goes closer to 0.
Yeah, it gets smaller. So if we are less than 1, this RGT is going to make us flow towards 0. Because x squared is less than x if x is less than 1. Of course, really what we would like to know is, what about beta j? Well, x is equal to the tanh of beta j. So what we want is to solve k for x. And tanh of 0 is 0. So this one is the same. But this one actually corresponds to infinity. And so this tells you, you only have a fixed point at infinity, or when t is equal to 1 over, what am I doing? Beta is equal to 1 over kt. So t is equal to, I just can't even remember. Beta is equal to 1 over kt. So t is equal to 1 over k beta. And so when beta is infinity, t is equal to 0. So this is the fixed point that we see. And this makes sense, because if you're any higher than 0, what RG tells you is that you're just going to flow to the infinite temperature case. And so we really only have an ordering at t equals 0 for the 1D Ising model. So these are k values, but I'm telling you this is t equals 0, and this is t equals infinity over here. Okay, just to show you quickly, I'm going to show you how you can get the eta critical exponent. Because it doesn't take very much work at all once we have this. Your notes also tell you how to get the new critical exponent. That takes a little more effort. But the nice thing is, since we are starting with an exact solution, we can get these critical exponents, which are based on the fluctuations. So if we have some gij correlation function, which is equal to SISJ minus average of SI times SJ. And your notes work through this with you. But basically, you can show that GIJ for the K prime system, this is the already decimated system, is just equal to G times 2i minus 1, and then 2j minus 1 of the original undecimated system. And that makes some intuitive sense. These points are closer together than these points, because we had more points to begin with. We got rid of some of them, so we went from 2i minus 1 to I. We went from 2j minus 1 to j in this new system. And then remember, this is going to go as I minus j to the 1 minus eta at criticality. And we know that criticality is at infinite k, so we can say that gij of infinity is equal to g2i minus 1, 2j minus 1, also at infinity. Or that I minus j to the 1 minus eta is equal to 2i minus 1, 2j minus 1, 2 to the 1 minus eta I minus j to the 1 minus eta. In other words, 1 is equal to 2 to the 1 minus eta. And this is really only true if this exponent is 0. So we get 1 minus eta equals 0, or eta equals 1. And I think that's pretty much where we need to end.